My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility, if you'll only try. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters, episode 19. It's been another interesting week in the world of the weird and wonderful. It's of course 72 years since the infamous Roswell incident, and the town has just spent its weekend celebrating its annual festival. We've also had the 42nd anniversary of the Sandra Mansi Champ photo, as well as a newly restored, seemingly in HD, analysis of the Patterson-Gimlin film, which seems to have confirmed the entrenched positions of both sceptics and believers. So 52 years on, no change there either. So I'd also like to congratulate one of podcasting's longest-running hosts, Howard Hughes from The Unexplained, based here in the UK, as he passed the incredible milestone of 400 episodes. Howard's show was one of the very first podcasts I ever got into about 7 years ago, thanks to my brother. Along with the Graylian Report and No Agenda. So it's testament to Howard's skills as an interviewer that the show has continued to go from strength to strength. So congratulations, Howard, and let's look forward to the next 400 episodes. I'd also like to wish Derek from Monsters Among Us and his fiancée Sarah congratulations on their impending wedding. Let's hope you two have a fantastic honeymoon. Right, back to today's show. And I'm joined by Nash Hoover from Chasing Legends. Nash and his team are a self-funded group of investigators who are building a reputation as a down-to-earth team with a refreshing, no-nonsense approach to their searches and work. We discuss Nash's motivations, the Chasing Legends team, the films they've made so far, cryptozoology, and their exciting new film as they went searching for the Beast of Bray Road. Don't forget you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, as well as subscribing to our YouTube channel. You can also support us on Patreon at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. And also, this week we've got a bonus episode coming as I dive headfirst into the nonsensical claims that the Ray Santilli alien autopsy film from 1995 is actually real. It just baffles my mind that this is back in the news, because I remember 24 years ago, summer of 1995, it was shown over here in the UK on Channel 4. And I have to say, within about 5 minutes, I was just laughing my head off, because I've never seen anything as clearly fake in my life as that. It's astounding that people are now trying to promote this as a real thing. So I'm very lucky to be joined by the man that created it, Spyros Malaris, who will be dealing with these new allegations and controversy. And let's hope we can finally put Ray Santilli's alien autopsy film in bed where it belongs to be left, because there is absolutely no value in promoting that as a real event. It's nonsensical. So anyway, moving on. Back to this week's show. So come and join me and Nash Hoover as we go chasing legends. This week I'm joined by Nash Hoover from the Chasing Legends crew. Nash and his team formed 5 years ago, and they've made some intriguing films which you can view on their YouTube channel. They have a down-to-earth, factual investigation slant to their work, which is so refreshing to see. So Nash, delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters this week. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Chasing Legends crew, really impressed with the films that you've done. Rewatched them all again today just to refresh my mind. What As a filmmaker and a writer, what's been the main impetus for you to sort of branch out and do these kind of things on your own with your team?
Well, the cryptid stuff I've actually been interested in actually long before I was even into filmmaking. And then when I started getting really into filmmaking, I, you know, kind of decided to combine both passions, and that's just kind of how it took off.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've said this to a couple of guests. I think for us right now, I think we're in kind of a golden age for this kind of documentary series or self-produced investigations, because I think the technology has come on so far in the last sort of 10 years that it enables a group of, with the greatest respect, of fairly young people, the opportunity to get out there and investigate things. So how did you come to get your team together? What was the process there? Were you all friends and you've kind of grown up together and being interested in this kind of thing?
Yeah, most of the guys that I've and girls that I've done stuff with over the years have been lifelong friends, or like my cousin Michaela is on the team as well. And then we have brought in some newer people over the years, but yeah, it's mostly been friends that I've had that I knew had a common interest in this stuff that I could, you know, count on basically putting up with what I would put them through to kind of make these episodes and find these stories and such.
Yeah, so would you? I think that I think you're being a bit harsh on yourself there, Nash. I think, what I really like about your films is that there doesn't seem to be any kind of embracing the more. I'm just trying to think of the word. The more kind of loose urban myth type stories. I mean, the prime example was obviously the gnomes that you went looking for in the Devil's Punch Bowl. I found that really quite interesting as well, because it obviously that's quite a modern addition to this story of strange things living in the woods and wherever. So how do you kind of choose your cases? Is it a case of location at the moment, or is it just, well, we just find this kind of thing interesting, that's the one we're going to go after?
It's kind of a varying different factors. Obviously we will, you know, we'll pretty much take on any sort of case, no matter like how far-fetched it seems, obviously with the case of the gnomes. But for us, how we look for stuff is we look, is it, you know, if it has to have a, you know, somewhat of a decent history of sightings or, you know, reports. And as long as there is at least one credible person that we can talk to that kind of knows the backstory on it, we'll kind of go in and film an episode on it. And really, the location doesn't really matter as long as there's enough for us to put a story together.
Yeah, I mean, is it difficult? I mean, obviously, because, you know, I'm sure we can both come up with a lot of stories that in essence are urban legends more than anything. I mean, it's quite interesting. I know, as you refer to the gnomes in the Devil's Punch Bowl, but during the film, you know, as you quite rightly say, you know, you look at Iceland has a long history of, you know, severe belief in these kind of creatures. Ireland is the same in regards to, you know, fairy paths and houses and things being moved, or roads being replanned so they don't sort of upset anybody. I've always found that those kind of aspects that seem to be, in essence, folklore, still prevail to the modern day in progressive countries like Iceland. It's a very strange thing.
Yeah, for sure.
So, looking back on how long you've been running now, so obviously your love of cryptids and things, I've heard you discuss this previously, and it's always nice to meet another fan of Monster Quest. I mean, that was a fabulous show. I mean, long term, I think that show is deeply missed. So is that where you you know, long term, is that what you want to try and capture, where you have that ability to go anywhere and look for these certain type of creatures, Ash?
Yeah, my long term goal for the show is to basically eventually be able to travel at will and take this around the world and just really tell as many stories as we can and just bring more awareness to some of these, you know, far-fetched, you know, maybe not so well-known cryptid cases around the world, and add further further research into the more well-known ones that could use a, you know, a relooking or a fresh take on things. So yeah, that's definitely the goal of mine, is to take this globally.
Good. I mean, it's always interesting when you're after this. So for you, you know, if I say to you, you've got an unlimited budget, where would be the first place you would go tomorrow?
Well, for me personally, I've always been fascinated with like the modern reports of like Tasmanian tiger sightings or thylacines. So I'd probably head there. Otherwise, I'd probably head to like Southeast Asia and start looking into like their kind of Bigfoot-esque cases. Yeah, I think that's the only ones I can think of off the top of my head right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are two that you should start with. So, I mean, strangely enough, I'm friends with a thylacine or Tasmanian tiger researcher, and she's put up some pictures this morning that, you know, to the untrained eye, as mine is, would seem to look like. I mean, I just find it an absolutely fascinating creature, simply because the amount of witnesses and people and, you know, and the backgrounds of these people that are seeing the tiger, it would lead you to believe that there's clearly some kind of remnant population bobbing about out there, isn't there?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, you can't really know, because it's, I mean, especially lately, there seems to be a decent influx of once thought to be extinct animals, you know, being, you know, found again. So it just kind of makes you question how they deem something extinct.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I'm not one for conspiratorial ideas, though on occasion I can be. I've always kind of thought that I think that there is some kind of official blanket ban on the admittance of such creatures. I think primarily because I think it had just turned into a turkey shoot, because there'll always be some idiot whose idea to do it will be just, right, I'm just going to go out there and bag one.
Right.
So in regards to that, what do you think that, you know, because, you know, there are thousands of alleged incidents, you know, since the animal officially passed off the record in 1936. So do you think that there's always that kind of potential, or do you just think that perhaps it's just a case of that there hasn't been enough tangible evidence for them to admit that they are there?
I think it's very possible that there are small populations of them still alive. Just given how, you know, the sightings patterns, and, you know, it's, I mean, you look at sightings maps, and it's pretty much most of the island of Tasmania has, you know, one, at least one, you know, reported sighting. And, you know, even in southern Florida, specifically like Victoria and stuff like that, like they have sightings all the time. I mean, yeah, it's unfortunately in a modern age where, you know, everyone's got a cell phone in their pocket, and no one seems to be able to get a decent photo or anything. But I think for what evidence is out there, and, you know, the descriptions some people have made that, you know, might not know enough about this animal to be able to describe it how they did, you know, I think it's possible. It's,
yeah. I mean, I was watching because my leisure time is usually spent researching and looking at such things, and I'm looking, like I said earlier, I've got a couple of interviews coming up where I'm talking to some first-class Tasmanian tiger experts in the next couple of weeks. So I'm really looking forward to that. And it was really interesting because I was watching a documentary that came out about 15 years ago. It was an Australian one. And they interviewed a chap there who worked for their park ranger service. And he had a face-to-face encounter with him. And as far as the official stance was, they believed him. And that sighting happened in 1982, I think it was. So clearly that, you know, it's something that's continued more than, I think, because a lot of times people tend to, you know, misidentification or hope or belief tends to override people's factual choices there, Nash. So, I mean, that's always something that I think clearly there is something strange going on out there.
Yeah, for sure.
So for you guys in your side, so what you've been doing, because I know you've been investing, you've been planning a few new films. So what else have you been recording or outlining where you and the team are off to next, or what have you already got planned for coming out this year?
We have one episode that we shot back in April that is still being cut together. Mm-hmm. And then as of anything new, we really haven't discussed anything. We would like to do a revisit to our older Lake Pepin episode and do something a little bit more thorough out there. So that might be something we do next. Other than that, it's just kind of I've got a lot of big goals for this. It just comes down to being able to afford it, unfortunately.
Yeah, tragically. Because, you know, with the greatest respect, at the end of the day, it's not just your time, is it? Because obviously the team, I suppose you've all got to check your itineraries and make sure your calendars are clear. So is everybody kind of based in the same area, Nash, or do you have to kind of pull them out of state or wherever?
Yeah, we all live within about an hour of each other. So it's pretty easy to get together when we do need to get together.
Yeah, and I think one of the best things about that is the fact that, you know, your state is quite a spooky place, to be fair.
Yeah, we have a decent amount of kind of strange things here.
Yeah, you've got, I think you've got the triple header. You've got UFOs, you've got your own Lake Monster. I think is yours Raytown Raid, I think, is your guy out there. Is he that your state Lake Monster, I think, Nash?
No, I think Raystone Ray is down in Pennsylvania.
Ah, blimey neck. Yeah. So with you guys having that, you know, that kind of cross pollination across the state, is it intriguing that certain states seem to be really hot for a variety of phenomena, or do you think that it just seems to be the same everywhere? It's just some people are more prone to reporting things in certain states.
I think certain states do have a higher influx of certain things, especially with our neighboring state of Wisconsin. Like, they seem to have tons of stuff. I mean, obviously, we shot the Gnomes episode there, and then our recent episode that we're editing, we shot in Wisconsin. Mm. And then obviously with our Lake Pepin sharing a border with Wisconsin. Wisconsin's a pretty unique place for this stuff. They seem to have a good amount of everything. Iowa to the south of us as well, they seem to have a good amount of stuff. Minnesota, I've found that there's a lot of haunted stuff here in Minnesota. There's not a lot of like ideal cryptid stuff, where like, you know, Wisconsin and Iowa, they've got a pretty good good mix of both.
Yeah. So, you know, as you refer to the Lake Pepin creature, I mean, what would you know, like you say, you're on about looking into that. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to speak to a couple of cryptozoologists who specialize in lake monsters. For me, I think they're probably some of the most intriguing creatures that we want to find. How have you found that, you know, looking at your background and the way you would approach these subjects, what do you think the potential is in regards to Lake Pepin? What the opportunity or potential could be there?
The sightings that we have come across are pretty compelling. The lake is it's the lake is pretty similar geographically to Loch Ness. It's not nearly as deep, but it's almost similar in length and width. And I mean, I guess I can't really give a positive yes or no, because it's just one of those things where it needs more thorough investigating. Needs more, you know, more boots on the ground approach, which, you know, was what I would like to give it. And the people that we've talked to out there, they, you know, seem pretty convinced that they saw something that shouldn't be there. And just some of the photo evidence that we've come across, it's pretty wild.
It is. I mean, it is quite interesting as well. And I appreciate you making the comparison with Loch Ness. It is very similar, like you say, the way the lake looks and its design and such like. And essentially, it seems that the people around there seem to treat their lake monster in a similar way to the way the people of Loch Ness do. That they seem quite happy to have them there.
Oh yeah, because like there's a, there's a little shop downtown Lake City, and you can get the Peppy branded T-shirts and stuffed animals, which I have one on my desk here, and they really seem to embrace it, you know, to a point where it could almost be viewed as, you know, is it more of a, you know, tourist grab, or is it actually them just taking advantage of, you know, something unique and just kind of using it to help, you know, kind of brand their town. You know, it's, but I mean, just from going down there, I know a lot of the shop owners down there pretty personally, just over the years of going out there so much, that, you know, they seem to, it, you know, they could, some of them seem they could care less what, if it's there or not, like it's not really going to harm their business or whatever, just because of, it seems like the tourism does just fine, you know, without knowing about it. So you kind of have to look at kind of both sides of it. I mean, they luckily don't have a giant statue of it, and, you know, kind of, they don't really like worship it in that sense, which I found very refreshing to when I, the first time I went out there, that's what I was expecting, was, you know, just, you know, full on hysteria that this, you know, just, way, you know, just way too much commercializing on this thing, and it really wasn't. It's one shop out of, you know, quite a few in the downtown area that are selling some things, and, you know, there's a local boat guide that, you know, has like a antique paddle boat that takes people out in the river, and he kind of will, you know, he'll bring it up briefly, but he doesn't make it a big deal. And so, yeah, I think it's kind of both sides of it are kind of playing factors, but yeah, they definitely seem like it's, you know, genuinely could be something out there.
I think the other intriguing thing is as well is that does Lake Pepin's story begin? I'm trying to compare it. I think they're very similar to Lake Champlain, that it was a French explorer that made the first indication of him claiming to have seen something in Pepin. Is that right?
Well, I think from what I've been able to gather and some other fellow researchers that have done research out there, it seems like the stories almost go back to like the Native Americans. And even, I guess, they have stories of, you know, something large in the lake where it got to the point where they wouldn't go out on the lake in their, you know, lighter birch bark canoes. They would use their heftier canoes to go out into the lake because they were afraid of this creature, you know, knocking, you know, capsizing their boats. And but yeah, I could be wrong about this, but I think like the very first like official like, hey, there's something out here, I think it was a logging company from St. Louis, I guess, were in the area, and they reported something, and it ended up in this St. Louis newspaper. I think that's kind of like the first like official like newsworthy sighting that kind of happened in the modern era.
Yeah, I mean, that is quite. I mean, it's one of those things as well, because I think we often forget that, newspapers were pretty new there, and obviously the states were still being colonized. People were still moving across the continent at that point. They hadn't, really got as many places as they had. And it does seem very interesting that several of these creatures all kind of appear around at the same time. Now, the cynic would say, well, that's to sell newspapers. But then again, you look at it and think, well, where are they going to sell newspapers other than where they are? Because, these people weren't, wanting their newspaper to go global. They were just hoping to sell a few papers to the locals. So I've always found that argument that these stories are just there to help sell papers, I think I've always found that quite a weak argument. I mean, I'm not suggesting that they didn't print fake stories, because we know they still do. but there's always been weird stories filling up little segments of newspapers for as long as we've had newspapers, I think.
Well, I think too, like to look at like back then, like, they really had no reason to even make up a story like this because, a lot of this, a lot of, cryptid sightings weren't, exactly mainstream like they are now, where it's, so they, it's not like they really had anything to gain by saying, oh, look, there's a lake monster in this lake. Like that's, it's, and it's, you kind of have to look at it in that aspect too of things where it's, they, someone saw something, and obviously there might not have been a lot of, worthy news stories back then either. But, someone reported something and they felt, okay, maybe people should know, hey, there could be something large in the lake, be cautious.
Yeah, and I mean, like you say, I mean, it's one of those things. The native legends refer to creatures all across America. All lake monsters. I mean, Champlain is another one where the locals would put sacrifices by the shore or wherever before they tried to cross it, and it's the same in some of the lakes in Canada. Okotoks and things like that. It's a very interesting cultural aspect to the thing as well, I feel.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's, I mean, that's kind of one of the other things that we like to look into when we are researching a case is like, is, the cultural aspect of things. And especially, not so much around here, but like, especially when we want to start going global and stuff, we, you almost have to, because a lot of the, cryptid cases around the world have some, local folklore, it's, a lot of them are, stories kind of passed down, by local tribes or, whatever you want to call it. So you, yeah, you have to kind of take into account the cultural, like you said, some, we're almost like in the Himalayas, they treat the Yeti as like a godlike, So you have to, you kind of get a lot of cases like that where they almost feel like it is something that they should, be worshipped and feared, and they take those measures of sacrifices and basically not trying to piss the thing off to, live happily.
Yeah, well, there is that. I mean, that is one of the things. You've got your three main, especially North American indigenous stories. You've got lake monsters, water monsters, wherever you want to call them. You've got Bigfoot, obviously, and you've got Thunderbirds. And these stories, this is the other aspect that I've always found intriguing about this, because, once again, you're going back to peoples that were essentially tended to stay where they lived. They didn't travel very far. There was very little cross-pollination between tribes, especially in certain areas of the Americas. There was vast expanses of lands that were virtually untouched by people, and yet a lot of these tribes all have the same kind of stories. They can't obviously have all met each other and passed them on. So that's always given me a bit of food for thought in regards to how these stories have been passed down through the oral tradition, Nash.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, it's not even just here. I mean, you look all over the world and you find similar patterns like that where it's, different, walks of people that literally have oceans between them telling similar stories of similar things. I mean, it's just, you know, it just kind of goes hand in hand with like the Bigfoot sightings around the world. It's like, how are this many different people that have, you know, never had, you know, could have never met whatsoever, telling similar stories of, you know, something similar. And yeah, it's oral tradition. It's pretty wild, especially with when you start looking into the fact that people are telling similar stories that have never heard of each other.
Yeah, I mean it's impressive enough when you think about it in the aspect of just the Americas, but like you refer to, you know, we've got these stories, you know, with the greatest of respect, the only continent where there isn't really a history of stories of giant creatures lurking in the woods is Africa, and that's because they had giant creatures lurking in the wood, and they're called gorillas. So, whereas everywhere else, you know, you've got Russia, China, obviously Australia, North and South America, and obviously more aspects in that. It is a really intriguing aspect to the whole thing, because if people, you know, it's one of those things that if people were making it up, they'd be everywhere, but they're not. There seem to be specific locations and historical countries and areas that tend to be the hotspots for these particular stories, I think.
Yeah, definitely. It's you can't really shut down any, you know, old stories like that because it's you it's out it, it's all this stuff is just it's wild. It's the yeah, it's just it's yeah, it's
I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, it's like fishermen and sailors are always, you know, accused of telling tall tales. And I think one of the aspects of, you know, they, you know, stories of sea monsters and whatever, and obviously probably the most infamous is the Kraken,
Oh yeah.
which was dismissed for years by biologists and whatever. And, you know, once again, we suddenly discover that, well, maybe they're not as large as what we were led to believe, but you know, we are fully aware now of what the giant squid is, and
Oh yeah, now that we finally are, you know, now that we finally found one alive and seeing realizing, oh, they actually are pretty big, you know. Yeah, you yeah, it's
yeah, there are
I
there are
mean, a lot of these stories, you know, you kind of have to look at them in the fact that they, you know, a lot of these stories are probably rooted in reality. Like, they saw something and they couldn't really describe it, so they just, you know, kind of made up or described it as best they could, and then just, you know, it kind of becomes a game of telephone, and, you know, everyone kind of exaggerates a little more and. But then you get those cases where it's everyone is pretty much describing the same thing, and those are the ones you really have to look into.
absolutely. And you know, at the end of the day, I think that the sea is ripe for these kind of incidents, because it's just such a vast expanse of space that, you know, when I speak to most people, I think, who are into cryptozoology and cryptids in general, Nash, the general consensus is that there is something that none of us could possibly expect swimming away quite happily somewhere in our somewhere in the seas, be it the Pacific or the Atlantic or wherever. There are strange things. I mean, you see things all the time that come up from the depths of the sea, and you're like, what the hell is that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the ocean is so unexplored. Like, and to even like for someone to even argue, oh, we've discovered everything. Oh, there can't be anything, you know, strange out there. It's lunacy. It's naive. Like, it's you. We live in a world where new discoveries are being made every single day, yet there are still people out there that believe there's nothing more to discover, nothing more to explore, and. The ocean, especially, it's, you know, we have barely even scratched the surface on what's out in the ocean. Like, it's
Yeah, I mean it's always been that kind of thing, like you say, and you know, everybody always mentions the coelacanth as a prime example of of something that wasn't supposed to exist. It was one of those, oh yeah, these locals have no idea what they're talking about, they're all daft, and then all of a sudden somebody finds one and goes, well, fair enough. The megamouth shark's another one that was discovered by accident, because they were actually, I'm trying to think what the Japanese, there were some Japanese scientists that were doing something, I can't remember what they were doing. And the megamouth shark was caught on camera completely by accident. But that was, once again, people had said, sailors and things had said they'd seen an enormous shark, and people were saying, oh yeah, it's just, you know, just exaggeration. And yet there it was on camera. And that was, I think that was 1995.
Yeah.
So, and like you say there, Nash, you refer, I think it's a very dangerous place to go, where you say, I don't think there's anything else left to find or to discover. Because like you say, every day, you know, something's turning up. We find species all over the place. You know, as we've referred to, there are extinct animals that keep reappearing when they're supposed to have gone forever. I find it a frustrating standpoint myself.
Yeah.
So in regards to going forwards with that, what do you hope that we, you know, because one of the key aspects is in any field of cryptozoology, what do you want? I mean, what would be the dream kind of confirmation for you of something being out there? What would be the one thing that you would love to get your hands on?
Whether it just be, you know, a clean, you know, crystal clear photo, video clip of something. I mean, I'm not one that's going to, you know, I'm not one to look for these things in the hopes of, you know, killing one and dragging the body in and slapping it down on the, you know, scientist table and say, look at this. It's, I'm out here to find them and leave them be. So yeah, for me, it would definitely be, you know, whether it be a concrete, conclusive biological sample that was left, or a just perfect, you know, class A crystal clear photo video of something, whether it be the Tassie Tiger, Loch Ness, some form of Bigfoot.
It's always the same argument, I think, every time. You know, everybody's always got a blurry picture or a wobbly camera or whatever, and I think it's one of those things that, you know, you yourself as a filmmaker, Nash, there are two things that come into play there. Is I don't think people can honestly tell you how you would react if you do, you know, if you stumbled across something like that. I think that's always,
oh, definitely,
you know, because people always, you know, skeptics would always say, oh yeah, I'd be fine, you know, why can't you keep your hands still, whatever. I think that's a very strange stance to take, because even in everyday life, you see accidents or things happen on the street by, you know, random chance. People's reactions are very odd, just to normal events. So, you know, to say that if you saw something that extraordinary, you would be able to remain extremely calm, I think it's ludicrous.
Oh yeah, it's, you get a lot of people that a lot of ego in those statements. And then those are usually the people that, you know, when they do come across something, they're the ones that are usually running.
Yeah, very true. I think as the old saying over here goes, those that usually have the least to say it the loudest. And I think that's it's always, you know, it's always a man in a suit, it's always a log, it's always swamp gas. and I've often said this, that sometimes I think some of the explanations are sometimes harder to believe than the actual potential cryptid answer.
Especially
with, you know, some of the things that are supposed, that people are supposed to misidentify. I just find it crazy. I mean, have you found it difficult so far, Nash, when you've been doing things, for two reasons really, and you know, with the greatest respect, I never ask anybody anything that being disrespectful. Has it been challenging for you as both a young filmmaker and also the subject matter to find people want to take you seriously, or have you found yourself being pleasantly surprised by people you've met?
I've gotten a good mixture, mostly positive. You know, you get those people that are pretty, you know, that, you know, pretty embrace you pretty much, you know, pretty well in open arms, and, you know, welcome you as the next generation. And then you get those older guys that, you know, they just kind of laugh you off because they're afraid of, you know, of their own, you know, selves and being replaced almost. And but yeah, it's been pretty positive. I mean, we've never been ones to act like we have something to prove. We are just out there doing the best we can, and we don't leave anything, you know, up to interpretation. We are always honest and completely open on, you know, what we're looking for and our findings. We do everything with an open mind. We are never the ones that, you know, are screaming, oh, it's what it is, it's what it is. We always, you know, we always try to, you know, we get excited when we're doing investigations, but then we kind of will tone down and we'll think about it and we'll have conversations about what it could be. And I think people have really, really appreciated that. And, you know, and I've heard, you know, and like when you kind of your little introduction for this, you know, you use the word refreshing. And I've heard that a lot when people have described what we do. And, you know, because we take a different approach, I feel sometimes. But yeah, all in all, I really haven't had anybody that's kind of had any negative. I think our reception's been pretty positive.
Yeah, good. Well, like I say, yeah, I mean, you've just referred to it there. I mean, it is incredibly refreshing because, you know, one of the downsides of this. Well, it's the only downside, really. There isn't, you know, talking about monsters and ghosts and UFOs is not what I would consider not having fun myself. But that's just me. And I'm sure you probably appreciate the weird as well. But I think you get to see a lot of stuff, and it, you know, I'm sick to death of seeing people investigate ghosts, and all you can hear for an hour is screaming. I mean, it's just utterly pointless. You know, and like you say, I found about your films and the way the team interacts is clearly there's a lot of friendship out there, which gives, you know, a really good kind of relationship for the viewer, because it's clear that you're all very good friends and close and care for each other. So it's a very natural kind of team ethic that comes across from when you watch your films, and it's also very balanced as well, which is great credit, because, you know, as you touched on there, Nash, it's very easy to kind of lurch to the ludicrous purely to get attention, and mm-hmm. the best thing for about you guys is that there's none of that at all. It's very simple. It's entertaining, but it's simple, it's factual. And you don't leap to conclusions, and I think you should all be commended on that.
Yeah, when I kind of had this idea, and when we were putting it together, you know, we definitely wanted to do something that was different, but kind of felt similar. Like, we didn't want to, you know, be way too left field. We wanted to kind of be like a happy middle. We kind of pulled from what, like, the show Destination Truth was, where it was, you know, it's like, yeah, you had your dedicated host with Josh Gates, but like the whole crew was involved. And I really liked that. You know, it wasn't just, you know, I didn't want to do something where it was just me by myself and just talking to the camera and, you know, nobody gets a word in edgewise. Like, I wanted there to be that, that communication. I wanted there to be that connection. I wanted there to be, you know, the ability to have those kind of funny, entertaining moments where we kind of joke with each other on things, like, you know, where you wouldn't be able to have that if it was just me doing everything alone. And, you know, like you said, you know, it's very obvious that we, you know, are close friends and actually care for each other, because, you know, I feel like we've always been able to play off each other's, you know, reactions and comedy, and we always try to tell the best story we can, and we always try to include as much information as we can. And
yeah, I think it's, I mean, and like you refer to, I mean, I'm a big fan of Josh Gates. I don't really understand why he gets a lot of heat, because he seems to, some people just don't seem to have any time for the chap. But I've always enjoyed everything he's done. I mean, Destination Truth I thought was a fantastic show, primarily because it was such a global spectacle, because they just went everywhere.
Yeah.
And I would imagine, like me, Nash, that's probably your dream job. Just,
yeah.
You know, right, where are we going this week? All right, okay, we're off to Sumatra. Right, brilliant, okay. What's next? And it was just that, and it was also the fact that they tended to go, I mean, some of the places I'd only got a cursory knowledge of, you know, certain cryptids and creatures and stuff. So it was really quite eye-opening. But yet again, like you refer to, there were some real dangerous situations. I mean, Gates is renowned for nearly killing himself once a season, I think. on everything I've ever seen him. I mean, I'm trying to think where they were, but he was on some kind of rickety bridge and it went while he was walking across it. And I just thought, what on earth?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he must have balls like like bowling balls. I mean, some of the situations and things like that he puts himself
in. I always loved that show when he would have something dangerous happen. He would look at the camera and be like, you don't see that on Ghost Hunters. Like, he's like good buddies with them, and he would always make fun of them. Like, I met Gates and he's great. Like, he's one of the nicest down to earth dudes I've ever met. And I've actually, I know some of the other, you know, people from Destination Truth personally. Rex Williams is a good friend of mine, and he's actually been a lot of help with with the development of this show. And it's like, you know, and I have been called like a wannabe Gates before, and I'm like, it's something that I always just kind of laugh off, because it's something that I always used to like joke about myself. Like, I'm like, and it's like, I know I'm going to get that. Like, I understand it. So I might as well just, you know, get ahead of it. So I'd always, you know, for a while on my Instagram page, it was in my bio was wannabe Josh Gates. Like, that was why I embraced it. But yeah, I knew I was going to get a lot of flack like that, and I have, but most of it has been positive. A lot of it has, like I said, like a lot of it has, like, it's very, very, very rare that I get somebody that like, that compares me to Gates in a negative way. And, you know, I'm not trying to be like Gates. I'm trying to be like me.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just happens to be that we're happening, you know, a lot of the inspiration for my show just happens to be a show that he was on.
Yeah, and to be fair, like you say, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with having someone as the level that you want to achieve, because, you know, like you refer to, in our sphere of interest, Nash, he's probably one of the most well-known proponents of it, really, because, you know, he seems to say, right, well, somebody said this has happened, this is what they're claiming, let's go and find out, rather than sitting in a studio dissecting it, saying, "Nah, we're not going to bother." At least he gets out there and does it, and I think that should be always be applauded. And like I say, I don't understand why he gets some heat. To be fair, because I've always found him quite an engaging, humorous chap, and anybody that can make, you know, cryptozoology and archaeology and history interesting should always be applauded, in my opinion.
Right. Well, I think it's there's. There's people out there that don't think that you can have fun while you're doing this.
Yeah.
And you take it way too seriously. I mean, you have to take it seriously. But it's like, if you're doing this and you are just straight faced, like, you know, there's just no, you know, no happiness to you, and you're just doing this, you know, because you want it, you know, I mean, obviously you're doing this because it's a passion of yours. But if you're doing it and you look like you're bored to be there, then you need to kind of change your outlook on things. Where it's, you know, like, obviously you get a guy like Gates where he honestly loves being there. He loves to travel. He loves to hear stories. He loves to tell stories. Like, it's just, and I think it's, it almost comes across sometimes where he isn't like there for the right reason, almost. Like, he's just kind of there to, you know, do a show. But the guy genuinely loves to travel.
Mm.
He genuinely loves to tell stories. He genuinely loves what he does.
Mm.
It's just he has fun doing it and makes it very clear that he has fun doing it. And I think, yeah, I don't know. That's, yeah, but I'm with you on that. It seems like he does get a lot of a lot of heat for no reason.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, I mean, if you're doing it and you're not enjoying it, then what's the point in doing it? You know,
right.
unless they're paying you. And let's be fair, there's not much money to be made in Monsters, as we can all say. But you know, despite the fact that you know millions of us around the world all love these situations, it's difficult. I you know, like I say, I think because he just seems to have such a childlike wonder in some situations. I mean, and I've seen him visit places around the world that in any other aspect I probably wouldn't have watched a program about that particular area of the world. But
yeah, exactly.
So it's a win-win because I love to see, you know, cultures and countries that I've not had the opportunity to visit. You know, places, you know, like he's been to Mongolia a couple of times, and that just looks an incredible place. Very, mm-hmm. very different to everything else that we, you know, that surrounds it, such as Russia and China. It seems to be a very unique country sandwiched over there, with a very different, you know, spate of legends and things. Obviously, the Mongolian death worm is probably the most famous one, one of the strangest cryptids out there.
Yeah.
You know, venom spitting monsters can be. But it just shows you, for me, it just shows you certain aspects of the world that you would never, ever see normally.
Yeah, it's. And, you know, that's something that I've also been trying to, you know, I try to do is, you know, you have to kind of show those off the rail places because they're the places that, you know, not many people are fully aware of and, you know, they're great places to see and they're just unique.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the other aspects. I think the other series of films that I've really enjoyed recently, the Small Town Monsters one, and they have a very similar slant on their films as well, as that they give a lot of history about the particular area, and they take you, you know, especially for someone like myself who lives in the UK, you know, going to places which to your average American probably aren't that exciting really, but when I look at states like Arizona and Nevada, I just think these places look like alien planets to, you know, somebody living in England, with the greatest of respect, because the whole environment and the topography, it's breathtaking for someone like me, you know, sat in a green town somewhere in the north of England, when I look at places like this. And I just, that for me is one of the other aspects about these stories and these interesting pursuits, is it also gives that kind of, you know, historical knowledge and environment that you probably wouldn't get.
Right.
So, long term then, you've just been saying that you've just done a new episode, and you're looking forward to getting that edited. Where did you take the team on that one, or is it still under wraps and you're going to release it and it's too top secret to discuss?
We went out to the southeastern Wisconsin, and kind of looked into the werewolf dogman sightings that are out in that area. Found some pretty cool evidence, and we, you know, heard some cool stories and some cool sightings, and it was a great few days of filming, and so yeah, I'm excited to get that kind of put together and out there. And
yeah, I mean, it's that itself, the whole dogman phenomenon is a very strange kettle of fish, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
I mean, there are some, obviously, I mean, anybody who knows anything about dogmen, I mean, obviously, you know, most of my knowledge is based on the wonderful work that Linda Godfrey's done over the last sort of 25, 30 years, you know, obviously starting with The Beast of Bray Road and then spreading from there. But for you, Nash, as a local, do you find it unusual that for Mick, because I think, out of all the cryptids that we're aware of, that one just seems to have exploded from nowhere.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's kind of one thing that when we interviewed Linda, she said, you know, she gets sighting reports from all over the country. Like, it's, you know, and we were just kind of there investigating one specific kind of, area. But yeah, it's kind of one of those things where I think like the BC Bury Road case kind of really kind of brought some stuff, to the forefront. And then from there, it just kind of took off. But I think really really Wisconsin and Michigan are like the two states that seem to have like the most, out of like anywhere in terms of like dog ban sightings.
Yeah. I mean, I just find it incredible really, because it's, I mean, the other thing as well is the explanation is in regards to dog, it's always a bear on its hind legs, always same as Bigfoot. It's always a bear on its hind legs, but some of these people have had pretty close up encounters. I think the one of the most famous early sightings is a forestry worker who was picked up a deer carcass on the road, and he chucked it in his back of his van, and this creature just turns up and pulls it straight out of the back.
Yep. Our first investigation we did for this episode, we investigated the area where that happened.
Ooh. Were you there at night?
Yep.
You're a braver man than I know.
So find monsters during the day.
Well, this is true. This is the other thing. If you've got a fear of the dark, cryptozoology is not the subject for you. I mean, when you with the greatest respect, when you go to certain areas like this, and you refer to Rex from the Destination Truth series, I think it's easy to forget that at the end of the day, you're in some pretty remote locations at night, probably a fair distance away from any sort of medical help. So in regards to preparing for the investigations and things like that, do you do recces where you go out and check the area and look out for certain things, or do you sometimes perhaps just do it off the cuff?
We always do it off the cuff.
Well,
we usually will have like a med bag with us, like a small one for like, those instances where stuff does happen. But we normally just really try to be as utmost careful as we possibly can. I mean, obviously you can't plan for everything, but yeah, it would just be too hard for some of the vastness of the areas that we investigate to scope everything out ahead of time. And especially when we're shooting schedules and stuff where we have to be other places and we can't always, scout stuff. So yeah, we just kind of show up and hope for the best.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose, one of the things I've always heard from certain people as well, and with the greatest respect, I hope I'm not prying too much. Do you guys, ever go prepared? Do any of you have a gun license? Are any of you trained first aiders? Because on a standard principle, Nash, you're probably putting yourself in certain areas where there is a chance you may run into a bear.
Mm-hmm.
What's that like?
None of us are like a full on, have medical training, which we probably should have some. I have a gun license. So if I feel like we're going into an area where, there is that level of danger, I will usually have it with me. But other than that, we just kind of, like I said, hope for the best.
Well, sometimes I think that's the best attitude to have, because I think sometimes you may miss something if you plan it. Do you know what I mean? It might be too good a plan.
Right. But we always, like I said, we try to bring what we know we're going to need. And then, like I said, we usually will have like a medical bag with us. And, a lot of these cases too, we're hiking in pretty far before we even start to film and investigate. So, we don't want to have to, carry in everything in the kitchen sink to, get to some of these locations, because it's just, it's going to wear us down before we even start. And
yeah, I mean, and the other aspect is obviously you've got two of the crew, you've got your cameraman and your sound man. They're lumping about pretty heavy equipment in some pretty dense areas, what you've done on your previous investigation. So I suppose that does add to the challenge, but I suppose the other aspect of that is Nash as well in your benefit. If something turns up, you could probably outrun a sound man and a cameraman, I would imagine.
My cameraman keeps up pretty good. My sound man, maybe not so much. He might have to ditch the bag. But,
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my sound man especially, he's got so much stuff that he carries in with him. It's especially this last episode we shot, we were in some pretty dense, like, pine forest, and it was, like, pine tree branches, like, pretty much down to the ground. So it was pretty fun, and pretty fun watching him try to make it through some of these things with his bag and his boom pole. And we always try to help each other.
Yeah. Hold the branches and don't smack each other in the face with them. Yeah. Well, I mean, even trivial things like that, Nash. Even a tree in the dark's going to cause you some damage if you're not careful.
Oh yeah.
As I'm sure you probably, all of you have had a run in with a branch or two. So, in regards to that, obviously the Bray Road, as you refer to, some tantalising. Is that probably the first time, and obviously you've referred to Lake Pepin as well. Is this latest investigation the one where you've gone, ooh, this is probably a bit more than we were expecting?
Because we did two investigations versus one. Like, it was two nights that we investigated two separate areas. That first investigation, which was, where the guy had the deer carcass pulled out of his truck. It was very hilly. It was very dense forest. It was, kind of marshy. We were kind of going through different environments, and it got tough for a bit where there was a few times where we just had to stop and just kind of like gather ourselves before we kind of pressed on. But really the Devil's Punch Bowl one, that one was, none of us were really prepared for just how big that place actually was. Mm. And there actually is a bit in the episode where my sound guy actually like kind of gives his like personal take on what he, his kind of like how he reacted to the place. And there was a bit that we cut out of the episode when we were trying to get down into it. We pretty much reached a point where like me and my one camera guy were like, we're scaling this waterfall. And I really wish I would have like left this in. It wouldn't have made sense because it just would have gotten for time. It just, we had to cut it. Mm. But we were scaling this waterfall, and it was like, we get down, we're thinking like, okay, we're pretty close to the ground. We should be able to make it this way. And we get down to the bottom ledge, and there's still like another like 10-foot drop. Mm. And, it's a big pool of water, and I'm sitting there, I look up at everybody, I'm like, I think I might jump. And everyone's like, no, you're not jumping, like, you're not jumping. And I'm like, I'm just going to throw the bag and jump. And, I looked at my camera guy, I'm like, are you fine with this? And he just kind of looks at me and laughs. I'm like, I'm serious, like, we're just going to jump. Like, I don't know how everybody else is getting down, but I said, we're jumping. I'm like, I wish we had rope or something so we could just rappel in, but I said, like, we're just going to have to jump. And it reached a point where I'm like, I was kind of looking at it, and my camera guy like kicked a piece of wood that was laying into it, and it literally hit the ground. So it's like the water was probably like a foot deep.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, like this isn't probably what we should do. Like let's break an ankle before we even start.
Yep.
So my sound guy ended up running up, and he's the one that found this other stairway to get down. And that's why there's that part in the episode where I look at the camera and I'm like, this is the right stairs.
Yeah, yeah, made me chuckle that.
So that's, that's kind of, we had, none of us had ever been there before. We just kind of looked at some pictures online, but it really never gave us like a grasp on like just how huge the place was. Mm. But yeah, those are kind of, that's just kind of like a little example of some of the stuff that I will put these guys through.
Yeah.
And But yeah, with the Dogman one, it was pretty crazy, especially too, because it was a lot of running around. This is like the biggest episode we've ever shot. Is this one that we just did. Everyone kicked ass. Everyone was there, and I was very happy with how everybody was, and everyone knew their place, and everyone just worked. And it's gonna be cool to see this all together, and I'm excited to kind of see what people think of it and what we found. And
yeah, absolutely. Well, I it's something that's always really intrigued me, and we've mentioned once or twice already, the Monster Quest Dogman, I think they did two or three episodes on this. They were very intriguing, like I say, because some of the witness reports, and it's just, these are experienced outdoors people. These are people that know the flora and fauna of their areas. They know what a bear looks like. They know what a wolf looks like. They know what a coyote looks like. And yet, these people are reporting something that should not and allegedly cannot exist whatsoever.
Yeah.
So for you to convince your team, and I think that once again she clearly shows that there is a lot of trust and care in this group of friends that you're working with, Nash. You know, because if somebody, most people say, "Oh, do you fancy coming to Wisconsin for two nights looking for werewolves?" I think most people would either look at you gone out or say, "No chance."
Yeah, I definitely lucked out.
Well, fair play to you all, because, like I said, I mean, to be, it's one of those things, because it's something I've done a couple of things that some people would think are very strange in regards to this kind of field, and I like a road trip to a well known strange location, but obviously in the UK it tends to be a lot easier to get anywhere you need to get to. Was it a natural progression for you to make this the biggest one you've done, or did you just feel that the subject deserved more attention, Nash?
I felt that it deserved the attention, and I think we were just kind of we were playing with a format, because like our format for when we wanted to make this like a honest TV show was each case was going to be hour long episode, one subject per episode, and it was going to be two investigations, and just so that we really could cover as much ground as we could, and so that's kind of what we, that this was kind of the will that format work kind of thing. So we shot three interviews, we did two investigations, and I think the episode will be good as it is, but I think it needs a little more of like what the other episode, the or older episodes have, that to really kind of make it perfect.
Yeah.
So I think when we have the time and the money to kind of do another big one like this, I definitely think we'll try the format again. But yeah, that was kind of like our idea behind it was, let's try this format that we created out, and if it doesn't work, then we, kind of keep things kind of how we've been doing it, or if it does work, we'll just keep doing it that way.
Yeah. And I think it's only natural, because as you all get more confident in your abilities, both as investigators and in the film side of it, Nash, I would imagine you feel more comfortable doing more and giving more content in that aspect.
Yeah, definitely. It's
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. I mean, do you think it's a natural way that you've evolved as a person, as you've matured and done this, that you can now see what to do in a clearer way, that you have a bigger idea, or do you just think that as with anything, Nash, the more you do something, the better you get at it?
I think so. I mean, our Devil's Punchable episode, we filmed that coming off of like 2 years of not doing anything. And that's that I picked that one because it was something that we had kicked around for a while, and I knew it would be close, and I knew it was something that would be somewhat easy to pull off, because, like, you know, I was kind of nervous, like, you know, we haven't done anything. Is everyone going to still be, you know, in the game? And I was blown away. Like, it was, you know, everyone showed up, everyone worked their ass off and shot that episode. And it almost, like, it felt like we had been doing it, you know, every day. And so I think, having that 2 year break to really kind of like rethink some things and go about, you know, things differently and kind of just, change some things. I think it really kind of helped us because, like, we came back with, like, a fresh set of mind, fresh eyes, and we were able to just do it. So I think, yeah, I think that one really kind of – that one was really great for us because it showed us that we can do it and we can put out, you know, good, solid content. And, yeah, that really kind of set the bar for us to keep doing things in a similar way and to keep kind of improving the things that need to be improved and adding things that need to be added. And, yeah, I think we're only maybe a few different ones away from having that, like, perfect.
Yeah. I think that it stands you in good stead as well, because, you know, as you refer to there, Nash, you had a 2 year gap from, you know, the last project that you'd done before the Devil's episode. I would imagine was it difficult to kind of hide your frustration at, it would have been very easy to veer into something a bit more sensationalised, if you know, not that I'm accusing you of that kind of thing in your previous work, but I think if you've not done something for 2 years, perhaps you can be a little over eager, if you know what I mean.
I think, and I see what you're saying. I mean, I think that's why we chose that one like we did, is because we knew it wasn't anything like huge that, you know, we went about it the same way we would, you know, normally. We just had a little bit more experience under our belt in various things. Like, I had worked on, in the 2 year gap, I had worked on some other projects that kind of showed me more on the production end of how to do things. So we definitely went into it with a different, a cleaner approach knowing kind of more what to do versus our previous stuff where it was, you know, we just kind of just winged it the whole time. So, like, yeah, like, the Devil's Punch Bowl and everything we've shot after that have felt more like a production than just a YouTube series. I don't think it was really... it could have gone any direction. It could have gone horribly wrong, but luckily for us, it went just perfect.
No, yeah, I thought it was an excellent little film. It is an excellent little film. I thought it was informative. Like I said, the stairs bit made me chuckle. So, you know, fair play to you. There's a bit of humour in there, and you know, like I say, you can see the dynamic between the team and how it all works. So. Fair play to you. I thought it was, and I'm sure, I think when I heard you speak to Adam from the Pine Barrens last year, I think you were saying one of your biggest bugbears is incidental music on these shows, when they say, oh, can you hear that? And then they play music, and you're like, hang on a minute, I can't hear anything other than music.
Yeah, we are, I'm pretty anti that. And obviously you've seen my stuff, so you know we put music in where it makes sense.
Yes.
And we just kind of let the environment do the talking and everything else. I mean, yeah, we could put it in like a suspenseful underscore, but it doesn't need it. Like you're able to see with your eyes, oh, there's something going on. Like, you don't need to feel anything more than just watching our reactions. It's
it is one of those things I've always found baffling, and it's happened in so many programs over the years. I don't know why they do it. I mean, what is the benefit of it? I mean, Finding Bigfoot was probably one of the worst proponents for it, as much as I love that show and the dynamic of the team, and some of the cases, you know, some of the situations just made me laugh, probably not for the right reasons. But that was one of the shows where they would say, oh, listen. And then they'd just play music, or there'd be things popping up on the screen. You're like, hang on. Is this supposed to be like this? You know, how bad is my hearing? I can't hear anything.
Yeah, it's like it takes away from it. It's like you know, obviously it's in shows like that, it's usually no fault to the people involved on camera. Like, it's usually a decision that's made after the fact. Yeah. And it just, you know, it just kind of takes away from, you know, what they've experienced and what they wanted to show. Mm. And so that's, you know, that's kind of like, you know, I've pretty much like passed up on making this show like a network spectacle. Mm. Because I enjoy having the creative control. Yep. to not put spooky music, and to really make this, you know, what people want it to be. You know, we try to, you know, be as engaging with our on Facebook and stuff like that with the people that like our page. You know, we try to make this what they want to see. And, you know, obviously, unfortunately, we're doing it that way. It's, you know, you're kind of left doing everything on your own expense, but you're putting out what I believe to be a more honest product.
Yes. Yes, very true. And I think that also is something that you know, you guys should take a lot of credit for, because it, in this day and age, as you know, and I'm sure you know more than most, Nash, it's very easy to kind of, you know, play to the crowd, and you know, television channels are swamped with Fortean and cryptozoological and paranormal programs that perhaps don't give us a fully honest product, shall we say?
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of, you know, as soon as you see the term for entertainment purposes, you kind of know what you're going to get. And it's,
yeah,
you know, as I always say to people, you know, I've done ghost hunting and poltergeist investigations. Ghost hunting and poltergeist are very, very boring things to do. I'll tell you that now.
But well, that's how I got into the paranormal, was doing ghost hunting and stuff. And it just got to a point where it was just, you know, I'm friends with a lot of people that do it, you know, and yeah, do it only. And it got to the point where it was so mind-numbing that it was just like, you know, I can't do this. Like, I can't sit in this room anymore and talk to the thin air. Like, it's, you know, and you get to the point where you kind of, you know, and also, you, a lot of the cases like that, though, you can't really go into those things with any expectations, because you're going to be let down. But for me, it was just like, I would rather, you know, and Chasing Legends in the early years was, you know, it was going to be a good mixture of ghost hunting and cryptid stuff. Mm. Or then it got to the point where, you know, all of the episodes, most of the episodes that we were shooting that were ghost related just weren't looking, you know, they just weren't working out. So we pretty much put the kibosh to it, and we will only touch like ghost cases if they fit a certain criteria that we've created. But yeah, like it's, you know, like I said, and no disrespect to the people that do it and enjoy it. Mm. I just can't.
Yeah, well, fair play to you to being honest, Nash. And, you know, it's not for everyone. And I think, like you say, it's one of those things that a lot of people go into it and just expect things to be, you know, banging about and talking to, oh, you, yeah, and things flying about and strange noises. And whereas in reality, you probably sit there for 6 hours. Everybody's a bit cranky because you're all tired. And it probably gets to the point where, you know, you're more worried about fighting or falling asleep, I think, than anything in some of these situations. Because, like you say, it's very difficult to stay sharp and focused when you've been sat in a room for 4 hours doing bugger all.
Yeah. Or at least, you know, at least when you're doing like the cryptid stuff, you're out in the woods, you're you know, in the middle of nowhere, and you know, there's always that sense of danger, because you know, you don't know what's going to be around the next tree, and it's, yeah.
Yeah, well, there's a bit more of a jeopardy aspect in wandering around the woods at night, Nash, I think. So yeah, whether you mean to, you know, bump into nature at its finest, that's the chance you will be taking out there. So.
Well, and it sucks too. Like, you know, it sucks that the, you know, that especially like network television, it's just so oversaturated with ghost shows.
Mm.
Like, we, you know, I pitched my show to a network and a production company, and they're like, this isn't what we're looking for. Like, you know, and I think someone actually said, you know, if you would have pitched us just a solid ghost, you know, like just a 100% ghost show, we may have considered it. Like, they wouldn't even like give me the time of day. And so that was like my moment of like, okay, I'm just going to do this by myself. Like, I mean, yeah, it's going to suck financially, but, you know, if people want to see it enough, you know, maybe we can kind of come up with a way of raising money to do us, to keep doing stuff. And
well, I mean, that's, you know, that's something else in your credit as well, Nash. You know, regardless, it would be very easy to think, oh, well, if that's what they want, that's what I'll give them. Because then that's not about, for me, I, you know, that wouldn't be about wanting to progress certain aspects of this field. I think that would be,
right.
You know,
you'd be pretty much be just, you know, you can't beat them, join them kind of deal. It's, and yeah, it's,
yeah, because I mean, like you say, I mean, to be fair, I think now, because of the rise in technology, and you just look at YouTube, you know, you look at, you know, the guys over the last few years, you know, Small Town Monsters have made several films, all financed themselves. You know, they do crowdfunding. They've had, you know, Seth said they've been approached a few times in regards to doing something, but they just don't feel comfortable at the moment. And I think that's because, you know, like you refer to, Nash, they want a particular product. And for them, they think that if they bring something on board, they can kind of cut your edges off and fit you in this particular box, and even if really it doesn't work, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So, you know, fair play to him. I mean, I think there's another guy in Canada, Justin Chinoplinski, Mountain Beat Mysteries. He's done 3 or 4 films about Bigfoot up there, all on his own back, and they're not like anything you would normally see in regards to, you know, your standard Bigfoot stuff. I think in one of his films, he has an interview with Ken Walker, who's a world champion taxidermist. And it's one of the most compelling interviews I've ever heard with a believer of Bigfoot. It's absolutely jaw-dropping. So if you've not seen it, I recommend it highly, Nash.
I'll look into that.
They're really good. Really good stuff. So for you guys then, going forwards, what's next? What's the next case that you're hoping to get the team together? Have you got something in mind?
I'm not sure. Like, I'm kind of looking into some things, and an easy one for us would probably be to do another Lake Pepin, you know, revisit. But other than that, I'm headed to Kansas City next month to speak at a conference, and
fantastic.
Doing some other speaking around the Midwest for the next few months. So other than that, that's kind of all we've got coming up. Would hopefully like to plan an episode or two for the end of the summer, early fall, but we'll kind of see what we are able to pull off.
Excellent. So when can we expect the Dogman film to be up and ready to go?
I'm hoping, kind of like the plan is to be out by like mid-September, maybe late August.
Absolutely fantastic. Well, the very best of luck with it. I'm looking forward to that thoroughly. Can't wait for that. But it sounds like it'll be fantastic.
Yeah, hope so.
Good. So listen, where can everybody find out more about you? Do you want to give us your links and tell people where they can come and subscribe and all the other things?
Yeah, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Chasing Legends TV. And you can find us on our website at chasinglegendscrew.com. And then you'll be able to find links to our YouTube channel from all of those. We have some videos embedded on our website as well. But yeah, those are everywhere you can find us.
Fantastic. Well, listen, all the very best of luck. I've thoroughly enjoyed everything you've done so far. Can't wait for this new film to come out. And just really look forward to what you and the crew have got planned next. And all the very best to you. Good luck.
Yeah, thanks, Paul.
Hey, you're very welcome. So thanks for your time today. You take care, and we'll speak again. And if you ever get a new film coming out and you want to come on and have a chat, you just drop me a line. All right, Nash.
Good to know. Thanks, Paul.
Very welcome. Take care.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you.